Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bill Buxton.
So, good morning. I can't believe you all got up. You mustn't have had any fun last night, or you're really, really dedicated. So anyhow, this morning, I just wanted to quickly introduce the two keynotes. And we have two different stories to tell you this morning. And one is from inside the industry and within Microsoft, and the other second's both from outside of Microsoft and the industry. And the second one I'll introduce later. But so just to get things rolling this morning, the internal one is just, today's actually a fairly important day within Microsoft in the sense that today's the day we launch Internet Explorer 8. And so we thought we might want to give you a little bit of insight about what's going on there. And to introduce that is the general manager of Internet Explorer, and it's Dean Hamanovic. And I pronounced that very poorly, and so without further ado, let's just get on with that, and we'll talk to you in a few minutes.
Oh, my friends and I had been partying for like 6 weeks straight, and then finally my friend Tommy just puked, and puke came out of his nose, and I took this awesome picture of it, and I got it back, and I was like, how are we going to distribute this? And I was like, boom, the internet. So I invented the internet, and then that picture got out there, and well, you know the rest.
Is this fascinating creation that has actually wired the entire world?
A vast series of interconnected tubes.
Levers. Magic.
String.
Dragons.
Kittens eating yogurt.
The internet is an ant farm on acid, basically.
Really felt like you were doing something.
In the early years of the World Wide Web, there was nothing on it.
4 million people writing poetry and 14 people reading poetry.
From the get-go, there were no rules. I mean, you wouldn't go into a grocery store and just show somebody a picture of your naked body, would you?
You know what? My is so awesome. How can I make sure people in Italy see this?
My favorite trend from the early web was looking horrible and completely defining everything with clip art. All of my emotions were somehow encapsulated in a waiter holding a bottle of champagne.
A lot of flames, or letters dripping blood and stuff, which is weird for a gardening site.
You can buy anything on the internet.
Snowshoes.
Fertilizer.
Raccoon tails.
Phosphorus.
Mag wheels.
Fuses.
Fuzzy dice.
A length of garden hose cut to a very specific length.
eBay really did change the marketplace because, you know, it's a perfect example of one man's trash is another man's treasure.
I once bought a bag of leaves on eBay.
There are pieces of content that either touch people emotionally.
Daddy bit me.
Or amuse them. Or they find outrageous in some way.
Power eating, power laughing, power spawning babies. You'll have so many babies. 400 babies.
Or that resonate with strongly held political or ideological or philosophical views.
You do know that there's no actual Candy Mountain, right?
Shun the non-believer. Shun. Shun.
That they just have to share with the people to whom they feel most connected.
Cat flushes the toilet. That's going to get around pretty fast. If a cat uses a toilet, your computer's going to explode.
To friend. Would you like to friend me?
You don't have to do the hard work or the heavy lifting to be a friend. You just say that you are.
It used to take years to learn that my friends were all but now with the advent of status updates,
I'm feeling confident, I'm feeling blue.
I can find out that they're six times a day.
Jennifer's not exactly crazy about this weather status, and then I comment back, hey, preaching to the choir.
I don't care! I am frightened about how fast the internet is now. I mean, it is ninja fast.
I'm just waiting for them to build a device that mainlines info into the frontal cortex.
It's called Microsoft Window to Your Soul, Home Edition, Premium.
The internet is so fast, we're actually introducing Internet Explorer 9.
Nom, 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 nom.
Internet Explorer 8 has this new feature called In Private Mode.
I wonder what that's for.
I guess if you're shopping, you don't want anybody to know. Unless it's... Oh, okay, I know why you would use it.
That accelerator's nice. You can just right-click and bam, you're there.
You know, I use accelerator when I'm in private mode, and then I'm like, it gives me this weird cooling sensation, you know.
The majority of our life, we are connected.
Your whole life is online. Everything is online.
The internet is now part and parcel of every aspect of our lives. That's where we're going.
Do you know what's important to the future of the internet? Developers, 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 developers. Some more developers. On top of that, put a melted layer of developers, smushed between two developers, and then I want you to sprinkle a little bit of developer on top of it. Developer. I eat!
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dean Hakamovich.
Good morning. Thank you for coming. MIX is an important event because of the people who come here, developers, the people who build the web. I'm excited to be here again to talk about Internet Explorer 8. Last year at MIX, we made 8 announcements about IE8, and we heard feedback. We heard 8 was way too many things to keep track of. So listening to feedback is an important theme. And I want to demonstrate data-driven in action right now by focusing on 3 rather than 8. The browser is important to 3 large groups, the people who build the web, the people who use the web, and the people who attack the people who build and use the web. Today, we'll show the opportunity in IE8 for people who build the web, how IE8 enables developers to integrate their sites into people's everyday activities. We'll also show the progress we've made on interoperability, standards, performance, and the other things that the people who build the web look for in a great browser. Now, to build a great browser for developers, we built a great browser for the people who just browse. The people who use the web need a browser that's faster and easier for what they do every day, all the time. And they need a browser that protects them from the real attacks that happen every day on the web. The challenge today isn't writing a browser. The challenge is writing one that just works, that withstands attacks, and delivers a great experience for how real people use the web. Looking at browser competition, nightly build by nightly build, you know, it's interesting to a small set of folks, and most of us are in this room. For all the people who care this much about browsers, there are many more who just want to browse. So to build it, we used real-world data from millions of people to make IE8 faster, easier, and safer for people's everyday browsing. Today, we'll look at how data drove IE8's design. Before we talk about the how and the why of IE8, we should talk about when the opportunity becomes real. Today, we're excited to release the final build of Internet Explorer 8. The final version of IE8 is now available for download from www.microsoft.com/IE8. It's available in 25 languages across Windows Vista, Windows XP, and Windows Server in 32 and 64-bit versions. And we are releasing it here at MIX because we're excited about what you, the developers who come to MIX, can build with it. Developers know that listening to feedback is crucial. So let's look at the data behind the design. We used real-world data to make people's real-world browsing with IE8 faster, easier, and safer. We combed through lots and lots of data from users who opted in. Hundreds of millions of users, hundreds of data points in the product, millions of browser sessions. We conducted hundreds of hours of usability tests. And we thought through the larger user goals and tasks. And never underestimate how many people click send error report after they crash. And the power of that data. Now, to see what we did with all this data, let's look at the product. We saw that 80% of navigations are back to where the user has been already. And that's why when the user types into the address bar, the address bar will show matches out of user history. Now, the search box also shows matches out of user history as well. This is because people don't always go to the search box to do a search. They go to the search box to get to where they want to go. And often, that's where they already were. Now, hear me out on this data. What's interesting about the search box from the data that we heard in IE8 is that 7% of the usage is selecting one of these items out of history. Now, that's huge in terms of a daily impact. We use data to refine as well as drive the design. Beta 2 also showed results from RSS feeds in the address bar. We saw that only 1% of users ever selected those results, so we removed them. If you look down over here in the search box, you'll see Quick Pick. We saw that 70% of users had more than one search provider installed, and we wanted to make it easier for users to use them. Let me come back to the page and talk about how people navigate. Now, before I came on stage, I was actually reading another article about the Final Four, about basketball that's going on right now. And we know that people are often closing things and then trying to get back to them. Restoring tabs that you've closed while browsing is easy and in the user flow with a new tab page. And you can also restore entire previous browsing sessions. So let me bring that up. And we also saw that browsing sessions often had an explosion of tabs. So I might be over here, and I'll open up a bunch of tabs. Then I'll come back over here to this article, and I'll open up several tabs. And what you'll see is that IE8 automatically groups and colors the tabs, so that even with interruptions, I get called away to a phone call or an email message. When I turn back, instead of just having a bunch of tabs, it's easier for me to keep track of which tab goes with which task. And this just works out of the box, no add-ons required. We also looked very closely at the data about how IE crashes. And it turns out that users don't care about the cause of the crash, they just don't want to be interrupted. So here's a video playing in another browser. Experience Hub. And we'll get the audio up so you can hear it.
Office Live will extend PC-based.
And I'll go up to another site, and then I'll go to some bad site, and the browser may crash. And you'll hear that I've lost that video playing. And I can bring the browser back up, and I can restore the session, but I've lost my place in the video. And I might easily have lost a lot of work that was in the browser as well. And I can come back here and re-navigate. Let me try that in IE8. I'll bring up this video. And I'll cue it up part of the way through.
Well, short of interoperability, if you look at that last...
Maybe over to there. And this is playing in the background, and I can hear it. And now I'll go to the site that I have that's under development. And you'll hear the other video playing. And when I crash here, the video keeps playing. IE keeps running. This is because we've isolated the tabs from each other. And when I crash, it's contained to just that process and doesn't affect the rest of the browser. In fact, when I come back here, you'll see that this is still playing.
Office Live will extend PC-based office scenarios into the social network, expanding the classic notion of personal...
And I can contain that. Now, containing the impact of a crash is just huge for users with many tabs going at once. Let's talk about performance. We also took a data-driven approach to performance. Now, we'll talk in a moment about how common activities take far fewer clicks in IE8. But now, let's look at performance data. Here's a high-speed video of major browsers loading some of the top sites in the world. These real-world tests show that performance is often a push. that most people would miss the difference in side-by-side tests if they blink. Looking very closely at the video, IE8 is often faster than the other browsers. Performance is complex. We often talk about performance on script benchmarks, but script is just one part of overall performance. And overall performance on real web pages is very, very close. We built IE8 to be safer. We built IE8 based on data to be faster and easier. We also built it to be safer. We heard people's concerns about online safety, and we looked to data. IE7 already blocks over 1 million phishing attempts a month. And from our data, malware is an even bigger threat to people who browse. Since we released Beta 2, IE8 has protected 1 in 40 users every week from downloading malware. Let's look at this in action. So I'm here in another browser, and you'll see that I'm on a site that seems to be PayPal. The page looks like PayPal, and looking up in the address bar, it seems to say paypal.com. If I come over here to IE8, you'll see that it says paypal.com.login.somethingelse.com up here, and that something else is quite bold. And it's a lot easier to tell what the top-level domain is. There are protections, small and big, that help protect users this way. Let me go and do a web search. I've heard about this product, and it's a perfect defender from hackers. So I'm doing a real web search, and it's a real web search site. And I'm going to follow this link. And here I am. And I have an opportunity to download a new generation of anti-spyware software. It looks great and talks about the many faces of spyware, and I'm ready to download, and I think I'll be protected. Let me come over here to IE8 and do the same search out of the same search engine, and you'll see I get a malware block page, and I'm really protected. Now, the short version is that not all malware protection is created equal. IE8 offers better protection against malware than other browsers. And you can read the white paper for yourself at nsslabs.com, as well as microsoft.com. On the web today, bad things happen to real people in many, many ways. As we've made IE8 harder to attack directly, the bad guys have taken new approaches, like attaching malware to screensavers, codecs, and other downloads. It's not just phishing and malware, but attacks on services like cross-site scripting attacks and clickjacking. IE8 is the only browser today with built-in protection to keep your users safe from many cross-site scripting attacks. IE is the only browser today that out of the box enables sites to protect your users from clickjacking attacks. IE puts the user in control of their browser and helps protect their privacy. So there is a browser available today designed from real-world data to be faster, easier, and safer for how people really use the web. What about developers? Well, with IE8, developers have great opportunities to integrate your sites into people's everyday activities. And that's good for end users, and that's good for you. Before showing the integration opportunities, let's go back to those 8 announcements about IE8 from last year. We committed to full CSS 2.1 support and working with the community to deliver a comprehensive test suite. That test suite is key to being data-driven. We want to move standards compliance and interoperability from opinions and anecdotes to objective tests at the W3C site. IE defaults to the most standards compliant mode, and it has strong developer tools. And there are hands-on sessions after this morning that will go into that in great detail. And these tools will help you whether you're profiling performance or tracking down styling issues. In addition to all the other things for developers, now I want to show you a real-world example of interoperability and the test suites in action. Here I've got Internet Explorer 8. And it's pointed at the W3C site, and it's at one of the 7,000 plus test cases that are up there. And here I've got two other browsers, and this is the latest Chrome from just a few days ago, and this is actually Firefox 3.0.5, but you can try this with their latest drop. You'll see, just looking at these pages, that all three browsers pass. And for thousands of these tests, all the browsers do the same thing and the right thing. Now, here is a CSS2.1 margin right test, and you'll see that there should be a green square, and this browser shows a green square, and this browser doesn't. Here's another test from the test suite, and you'll see that the following two lines should be the same, 123 and 123. And in IE8, it shows 123 and 123. But in this browser, it actually shows 134. Now, these examples are real-world interoperability problems just waiting to happen to you. For example, here is a Contoso site, a sample site from the Contoso company that I'm sure you've seen in the past. This is Contoso Traveler, and it looks pretty good, and it looks the same in IE8. And in this browser, you'll see that there's some extra red, and the alignment isn't quite right here. Here's another sample site. Here you'll see the steps that the site gives to the user go 1, 2, 3. And here in IE8, they go 1, 2, 3. And here in this browser, they go 1, 3, 4. Now, what you see here are the websites before developers spend their time on the real-world interop issues. Standards are incredibly complex. Every major browser is trying to be a great browser for web standards. Now, there may be other tests and sites that show other problems across implementations. And because many standards aren't yet capital R recommendations yet, it's impossible to be truly complete on many standards today. At the same time, we are committed to standards. IE8 passes more CSS 2.1 tests than other browsers. And these sample sites show our motivation. You need consistent behavior across browsers. We focused on the test suite and delivering as complete an implementation as possible so that you can spend more of your time making great sites, not dealing with issues. So step one with developers was making it easy for you to build great sites with standards, interoperability, performance, and developer tools. Step two is creating new opportunities for you. It's no longer just about a great website. We want to make it easier for your sites to be part of how people use their browser and the entire web all the time. Think about what information your site has that your customers want one-click access to, no matter where they are on the web. That's a great web slice. Think about what services your site offers that people want access to when they're on other sites. That's a great accelerator. Think about how visual search can help pull users back to your site. Now, these are all opportunities for your site to be part of how people use the web all the time. Let's look at some examples. So here I am reading that electricity article that I was looking for before. And as I'm reading, you'll see that I have one-click access in the browser to all the information on the web that's important to me. So I'll come up here, and I can see the most emailed articles on the New York Times. And with a click, I can see the ESPN headlines. I can check on my mail. I can check on traffic very easily. One Riot is a company that's taken advantage of this in a very interesting way. I'll click around their slice, and you'll see just how interactive it is. I can even perform searches in here if I want. Now, One Riot is a company that offers real-time search results for what people are talking about on the web. And they found that users who run their web slices come back to their site 18% more per day than average users. From a developer point of view, this is easy. Just take your current site and add a few tags around content to make a web slice out of part of the page. There's no script, there's no debugging, there's no special work, just a few tags. From a user point of view, this is a great way to help them keep what they like about your site handy and one click away. Now, this was a deliberate approach to extensibility in IE8. We built in the functionality that broad sets of users expect in the browser, developer tools, or tab coloring and grouping, so that people just have that functionality out of the box. Then we enabled extensibility with web slices, accelerators, and visual search. With IE8, developers don't have to write script and extra code to integrate with the browser. Let's go back to the data. 18 out of the top 20 commands in IE involved navigation and tabs, the act of getting to the site you want to get to in the tab that you wanted to get to it in. And it's really great to ask different groups of people what else made the top 20 commands. Folks who print a lot say printing. And college students suggest delete browsing history. A lot. What people do is manually switch and manually stitch different sites together with copy and paste. The data was clear. People copy, new tab, navigate, paste. And they do that over and over again. And accelerators make this easier for users. So here I am on this article. And I think this is a great article, and I want to do something with it. I can select something particularly important to me and click on the accelerator button, and now I can just blog it with a click. I can tweet. I can share on Facebook. I can use my preferred email provider, whatever it is. I can use Shareaholic. This is an add-in that the Shareaholic author put together rather quickly after hearing about accelerators. It's quite nice to see it in IE. I can go over to another site, and I can select some text, and even though it's not an address, a physical address, I can go and get a map of where that is. And this is an interactive map that I can move around and change in different ways. I can even look up music and start listening to what this might sound like. You see one of our international partners. Now, it's easy for users to add these services to their browser. These services are easy for developers to offer. It's just a little markup. Again, no script, no debugging, no hard work. Visual search speaks for itself. We're in Las Vegas. I'll look for Elvis. You'll see that I can switch around using Quick Pick to different providers. Here are the live search suggestions for Elvis. There's more than one Elvis in the world. I can try and see what different other sites did. I can pay attention to how different sites took advantage of this in different ways. For example, here's what Wikipedia does, which is quite different from eBay and different from Amazon and different from what a great news provider like the New York Times might do. No headline mattress for Elvis today. I'd like to call out some of the amazing partners who have built on IE8 so far. I want to thank them for their work. Dig today has a new accelerator out with a preview that's just fantastic. The ESPN slices are just amazing. I strongly suggest you try them, going up to ieaddons.com and check them out. And there are also some amazing add-ins available worldwide from different partners. For example, Sina in China. There are over 1,200 available today. All right, let's talk about what's next. First, as a team, we want to thank everyone who used our pre-release software and provided feedback. You helped us deliver IE8. We also want to thank all the partners who have built on IE8. You've shown that together, we can make the web better for users. Our next steps start with listening. We're going to listen to IE8 customers and respond appropriately. We're going to stand behind this product and service and secure it for many years. We'll continue to engage websites and developers on compatibility. We're going to work with standards bodies. And we're going to apply everything we learned to the next version of IE. Now, the release of IE8 today isn't really an end, but the beginning of a great developer opportunity. And what matters most for tomorrow is what you, the developer, start doing today. It's very easy to underestimate this opportunity. 10 years ago yesterday, Microsoft released Internet Explorer 5. The Wikipedia article at IE5 says that it gave birth to Ajax, even though the term Ajax wasn't coined until years later. There were no headlines the day IE5 shipped about the revolution about to happen. Now, that was 10 years ago. We can do better, faster, together with IE8. The next step is up to you. Microsoft loves developers. What developers do with IE8 makes all the difference. We're excited to work with you. Thank you.
And now for something different. So, when I talk about design, I actually like to take examples that are outside of the digital world. So, for example, yesterday I talked about mountain bikes. Other places, if you got the book that was in your package, you talk about juicers, avalanche beacons, and things like that. And for me, there's a really good reason for that, because by going outside of our world, in a way, adjusting a lot of the prejudices and habits that have built up just from working in your own narrow domain. But also there's a degree where you can get some objectivity, get some distance, and see patterns that you can take from these outside worlds and bring back into our own practice. And it's with that in mind that we saw the work of the next speaker. And let's be very clear, she is absolutely not from our culture. For her, a developer is the place where you take your photographic film to get processed. She's from a different culture. And precisely because of that difference, she brings immense value and interest. Think about it, in a sense, she's somebody who's in her design. This is, it's like a Cinderella story. The design grew out of her master's project at design school. But it's design and technology not to die for, but to keep you from dying from. And she revolutionized the packaging and labeling of pharmaceutical drugs. And if you've got a grandmother or somebody sick in your family, somebody with dementia and Alzheimer's, or just somebody whose life depends on pharmaceuticals, you can thank her work largely for maybe keeping them alive. Because as she will say, the risks of accidental taking of pharmaceuticals and medicines is huge, and the costs are huge, and the direct people we know. And so it's with really a lot of pleasure I get to introduce Deborah Adler, and I hope as a visitor to our culture you give her a warm welcome. I think we have a lot to learn. Deborah.
Good morning, and thank you so much. But I do want to let you on a not such a big secret. I was puzzled when I got the invitation to speak to this group of brilliant web folks, because I'm not too savvy when it comes to web design or development. But then I learned that you call yourselves UX professionals. And UX means user experience. Well, okay, that's all right then, because I know a lot about user design. When you come right down to it and wipe away all the high-tech jargon, you, me, we're all of us in this mysterious business of creating an experience for the customer. And when you can employ design to make that experience a comfortable one or an informative one, well, then you've done your job. For example, when I began my attempt to transform the way prescription drugs were packaged for consumers, I didn't start by researching the healthcare industry. And I didn't start by researching the pharmaceutical industry. I started at the bottom, the way any designer would. In this case, it was with my grandmother. I took a scary episode that she had gone through and tried to change it into a safer, more reassuring experience. Since she was my grandmother, I really understood my customer, and I was able to empathize with her needs. But I was surprised to discover how easily grandma's needs translated into the needs of all of Target Corporation's pharmacy customers. This morning, I'll be showing you how a personal family situation helped create a different and more comfortable experience for the uncertain and most likely confused prescription drug user. This is my grandma Helen. Several years ago, she mistook my grandfather's medication for her own. His name was Herman. They were both prescribed the same drug, but just different dosage strengths. When I looked inside their medicine cabinet, I wasn't at all surprised that the error occurred. This was their medicine cabinet. It wasn't caused by poor eyesight or carelessness. The only difference was the dosage strength and their packaging. And the packaging was practically identical, but the only difference was the dosage strength and their first names, which begin with the same two letters, H-E, Helen and Herman. This could have easily happened to someone in their 20s or 30s, and it could have led to a much more dire outcome had my grandparents been taking other types of medication. So as a granddaughter, I was alarmed for the health and safety of my grandparents. But as a designer, I saw an urgent problem that was just begging to be solved. So I started research on the topic, and I quickly realized that my grandparents were not alone in their befuddlement. I should back up and say that I started research on the topic because at the time of the incident, I was getting my master's in design at the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan, and I had to come up with an idea for my thesis, and it had to be an idea that I could effectively and eventually bring to market. So when I started researching it, I realized that they weren't alone. For example, this is Sarah. Sarah's prescribed Cardizem CD for her high blood pressure. Because Sarah's capsule was too large to swallow whole, she chewed her medication. She became progressively weaker, and she died 3 weeks later. Unfortunately, she missed the words, this was her medication, and she missed the words on the bottle warning her that the tablet must not be chewed and it has to be swallowed whole. This is Henry. Henry suffered from rheumatoid arthritis and was prescribed a low dose of oral methotrexate. And oral methotrexate is a drug for cancer patients, but in low dosages, it's known to cure things like rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis. Nevertheless, this killed him too after he misread the label on the bottle and took one pill every morning instead of every Monday. This was his medication. Could you have made the same mistake? Because I was shocked to learn that 60% of Americans don't take their medication correctly. The number of prescriptions filled in the U.S. each year equals more than 10 per person. If you multiply that by the U.S. population, roughly 300 million, you're left with a staggering 3 billion prescriptions a year. That's a lot of room for medication mishaps. At the time that I was doing my research, we were spending $76 billion a year to purchase medications in the U.S. and another $76 billion to treat the complications that happen when people don't understand how to take their medication. I know that number may seem small compared to the bailout plan, but let's keep things in perspective. That's a lot. So as I collected and studied the standard pharmaceutical bottles, it became more and more clear to me as to why these horrible accidents were happening. Information on the bottles are terribly inconsistent and difficult to read. And not just because of poor placement or poor print quality, but consumers often have to turn the bottle in a full circle to read all the information. And that's a problem because you can't get everything at one glance. And a lot of times that critical information is often covered by a warning label. Some warnings are printed on wraparound bottles that don't quite fit the bottle. And of course, that means that important directions are often covered or misaligned. To make matters worse, sometimes we have these orange warnings on top of orange bottles, making them much harder to notice, much less read. Then we have black text on dark colored backgrounds, also making the warnings difficult to read. The warnings that you can read that do have a lot of contrast, take with food or do not take with nitrates, well, that's an improvement. But what is a nitrate anyway? And consider the confusing icons that accompany the warnings. The take the medication on an empty stomach on the top right, that to me looks much like a gas tank. The longer, more detailed instructions that get stapled to the bag and usually end up in the trash can when the patient gets home are not much help either. And on the rare occasion that it doesn't get thrown into the trash, this is what you're left with. Tedious lines of text that are very difficult to read and discouraging on the eye. As designers, I know that people's eyes get tired after reading about 9 to 10 words per line. They get tired, they want to go to the next line. That's why we've designed books. For an even faster read, we have the newspaper set in columns. I'm not sure what the average line length on a website is. I'd be curious to know. But this is twice the average line length on a book, maybe 22 words per line. There's leading issues, kerning issues. No wonder why no one wants to read that stuff. So as I said earlier, we had a very big problem that was begging to be solved, but not by pharmacists or physicians. To me, this was really a designer's problem. So I set out to make that my thesis, and this is what I did. The first issue that I attacked was the label itself. The most clear and prominent information on this label is the drugstore logo. And the patient's instructions, take one tablet daily, looks like it's part of the patient's home address. And take that number 10 in the left-hand corner. Is that 10 pills, 10 times a day? Who knows? There's also no hierarchy of information, which is a really big problem because it makes something like the name of the drug, Levaquin, which is quite an important part, end up at the bottom of the label, tucked in between some other information. It could easily be confused for a manufacturer's name or a generic drug name. In other words, information on the label is very disorganized and difficult to read. Some information means nothing at all to the patient. It's even cryptic. So that's when I set out to redesign the label. My goal was to give the consumer, more confidence and security when taking their medication. And I did this by understanding information architecture and combining it with my own intuition, as well as pre-existing cognitive schemas. And that is to say that if I were to give all of you in the room 5 points on how to take your drug, what the name of the drug is, how to take it, the quantity, the doctor's name, etc., probably about 60% of you would put the first three in the same order. It's just a cognitive schema that you're already used to and that is pretty intuitive. So I tapped into that and I pulled up what I felt the most important information was and called it primary information. And nothing else is ever allowed to infringe on that area, and that's everything above that black horizontal line. Primary information includes the name of the patient, the medicine name, the dosage strength, the purpose, the main instructions. Then below that segmented black line, I call secondary information. It's still important, but not as critical as the primary. This includes the expiration date, refills, quantity, doctor's information, name, telephone number, etc. And then I moved the pharmacy logo out of the way and off to the side. I originally wanted to make this a standardized label, so it was a universal prescription label, and it didn't matter which pharmacy you would go to, you would always have the same prescription label. And I was hopeful that by understanding these adult schemas, it would also hopefully increase a patient's memory, which is to say that you'll anticipate where the name of the drug is, for example, every time you go to take your medicine. If I gave you the old prescription bottle and I had you shut your eyes, you probably wouldn't be able to even show me where the name of the drug is. And in this case, I was hopeful that you could. I applied colors to my labels, and I did that to personalize medications for each member of the household, sort of like toothbrushes. That way, no two people in the same house would ever have the same color. And I think this alone would have stopped my grandmother from taking my grandfather's medication. For my thesis, I changed the shape of the bottle, and the reason was simplicity itself. It gave the bottle a front and a back, so you no longer have to turn the bottle in a full circle. The front has all the instructions, and the back has all the warnings. I am not an industrial designer, so I had to make my prototypes out of plexi tubing and dollhouse materials. I used whatever tools I could to get my ideas across. You'll notice that there are grooves in the back that I included so that an information card can slip in and out of. So that sheet of paper that used to end up in the trash, I redesigned so that it's a trifold in columns and fits behind the bottle so that the patient has it with them at all times. I wanted to design these bottles so that people would know in a glance who it belongs to, what the name of the drug is, and how to take it. The label also has space for pharmacists to clearly indicate key information, such as time of week, or time of day, or what it's for, on how to take your medicine. I included a magnifying lens in the back of the groove, in those back grooves, so that people who had difficulties seeing small type could use it to help them. I love this story because I went into a building in New York one day, the Condé Nast building, and I received this badge to go up to meet with the creative director when I was doing my thesis. And the I went up, I met with the director, I came back. The next morning I had these red marks on my badge, and I realized it was a time-released security badge so that if I went back, I wouldn't be allowed back in the building. And so I chased this technology all across the country to figure out who makes this stuff, because I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could apply it to our medicine labels so that when it expires, a big red X appears and you know not to take your medicine. Well, it turns out that the company that makes, the family that owned this particular labeling system, they belong to the same synagogue that my grandmother, who had the medication error, belonged to. It's one of those weird cosmic coincidences. Anyways, hopefully this is something we can see in the future. A lot more R&D has to go on for it to last for a year, but we'll see what happens. So these are the final prototypes that I brought to, that I presented to my master's design thesis panel. And after graduating, they came in quite helpful. I brought my prototypes to the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, with the very high hopes of making them a federal standard. It was quite ambitious. And while the FDA was supportive of their idea, of my idea, unfortunately, their hands were tied for a couple reasons. But the biggest reason was that each state has their own board of pharmacy, so it's not really governed at the federal level. But nevertheless, their support gave me confidence, and I quickly realized that the fastest way into the bloodstream, no pun intended, was through a national pharmacy. And that's when I contacted Target. I knew that Target would be an excellent platform for my product. They're committed to their customer, and they always go the distance to create that customer loyalty. But they're also committed to excellent design. It's the core essence of their brand, as seen in this commercial.
To me, design is about simplicity. It's about inspiration.
It's revolutionary.
It's handy.
It's adventurous.
It's a new perspective. It's fluid.
It's sleek.
It shapes.
It brightens.
Everyone can afford great design.
I just had a feeling that they would be willing to take a risk with this sort of innovation. And as you can see, I was right. Target took the idea and me under its wings. Working together, we refined my ideas and we developed the ClearRx system. It was an endless collaborative effort, including Target technology team, pharmacy team, operations, training, marketing, you name it. I worked closely with an industrial designer, finally, to create synergy between the bottle and label. And I think there's an important lesson there, because I could have, you know, I could have tried to keep my thesis and keep the truth to it as much as I could, but ultimately, I really wanted to keep my eye on the bigger prize, which was getting these ideas out into the public. And in order to do that, you really have to collaborate and work with all sorts of different people to make that happen. So they were great partners, and it was a humongous collaborative effort, as you'll see. One by one, we developed the label, card, and bottle designs that achieved my initial goals, but also met the real-world needs of doctors and pharmacists. The first thing you might notice about ClearRx is that it's built for human interaction. It's designed to fit the hands, eyes, and minds of those taking prescription drugs. And the wedge-shaped bottle is easy to hold, and its flat surface serves as a platform for all of the relevant information on the label. So no longer do you have to turn that bottle in a full circle to get the information. My idea for color-coded rings was translated, for color-coded labels was translated to color-coded rings. They're available in 6 colors, and they attach to the neck of the ClearRx bottle. Each family member is assigned a color, and that pharmacy ensures that this color is consistently used with that person, and that provides yet another line of defense of, for someone taking medication that might be meant for someone else. You'll notice that the label is very close to my original. The information is presented in a clear and intuitive hierarchy. The name of the drug is listed big and bold at the top of the bottle, making it very easy to determine the contents at a glance. Now you can see it before you had to search for the name of the drug. And this quickly touches on what I had to go through when I was dealing with the state boards of pharmacy. That was a real thorn in my side because each state has their own rules. So New York and Rhode Island, for example, you had to have the patient's home address. Well, no other states did. So I didn't really want to use that real estate if I didn't have to because it was just cluttering the label. So we had to develop 23 variations of the same label to make a successful national rollout. We designed a patient information card, and that's securely tucked in the back of the bottle now. And it summarizes common uses, side effects, what to do if you miss a dose. And this card stays with the bottle at all times. But it's also provided in addition to a written monograph, which I couldn't fully get rid of. And now the magnifying lens also fits right behind that label. Right behind the patient information card, sorry. I want to quickly touch on pharmacy operations and logistics because I had to develop a system that would be easy for the pharmacist to use. The final label is actually 8.5 by 14 inches high. And one of the challenges was to design a label that would fit within a printer that Target already has. We didn't want to have to buy new printers. So we had to really work with a RX label producer to get things like dye lines and punches and scores and everything right so that it would make the pharmacist have an easy job. So this sheet holds all the information. We got duplex printers, duplex printing cartridges in all the printers to make it so that we could have double-sided information too. So the pharmacist simply takes the stickers and puts them on the bottle, and then that smaller card gets detached and folded and stuck behind the label. And then that bottom card is the written monograph, which I redesigned and made it easier to follow. And it fits inside of this binder, which is now, it has three holes, and it can keep track of all your family's medication. We also designed a little medication organizer, which magnetically sticks to the spine, and then you can stick it on your fridge. I don't know how successful that was. I don't think the magnets were strong enough. I worked with Milton Glaser to update the 25 most important warning and instructional icons. Take, for example, the new icon for avoiding taking medication while pregnant. Or to read all instructions before taking this medication. Or I love this one, that taking medication could cause drowsiness and impair one's ability to drive. Also, you'll notice that these icons are printed in a horizontal format, and this ensures that there's enough real estate on the label to include all of the relevant icons. And this wasn't always the case, as you know, with the old bottles. One of the most popular innovations of ClearRx is the spill-resistant bottle for liquid medicine. So instead of pouring amoxicillin or any other liquid medicine onto a spoon and oftentimes all over the floor, all you do is simply insert a prepackaged syringe and you can draw out the precise amount of medication. And hopefully this has been a big hit with moms, and it's our hope that it will improve accuracy in administration and duration of therapy. When Richard Carmona, the former U.S. Surgeon General, reviewed ClearRx, he thanked me for pursuing this redesign on behalf of my grandparents, which was very exciting. He said, her commitment could potentially help millions of people across the country be safer and healthier as they take their prescription medications. He also said, I'd like to congratulate Target on its leadership in designing a new, more easily understandable prescription bottle. The new design is a simple yet important step improving the health literacy of all Americans. And again, I think that really shows the strong collaboration between a company and a designer. New York Magazine first broke my story about ClearRx, citing its useful design and its unique user interface. And that was an important piece for me, and I think for the design community, because it really told the story from the designer's perspective and from my grandmother's perspective, and it could have gone a much different way. So it helps show that design can affect change. We've received awards ranging from the Good Housekeeping Institute to the Institute for Safe Medicine Practices. It's been hailed by Time Magazine, Business Week, New York Times Magazine. And as a designer, obviously, this has been an amazing journey for me. I like to share this picture of a pharmacist. Don't mind his head being chopped off, but his name is Patrick, and when we were, we first had a beta test the system to make sure it worked, and we picked about maybe eight pharmacies throughout the country, and this is one of them in Florida, and I was able to go out there and watch, you know, watch the beta testing go on. And this is one of the first prescription bottles that were filled, and I got to witness it. And that's really when I realized that something that started as a school project has really become so much bigger than I am. And this is something that Patrick can really take ownership of, and rightfully so, because he's the one on the front lines that is delivering the medication and dispensing it, and he's a very important part of this big picture. ClearRx is raising awareness in the medical community, the design community, and in popular culture. People are paying closer attention to what the patient gets now at the end of the day. Throughout this process, I really learned firsthand that design has the power to make a difference.
Easier to read pharmacy system. ClearRx from Target, a revolution in pharmacy.
So not only did it make a difference in people's lives, the people that are taking the medication, but it also made a pretty big difference in Target's bottom line. People, I don't think people even knew that Target had a pharmacy. I remember seeing footage that someone in a Target pharmacy area getting Tylenol. And someone was asking them, you know, did you know Target had a pharmacy? And there was a huge pharmacy sign over the guy's head. And he said, no, he had no idea. So it's really that awareness, I think, has helped them in increasing their market share really significantly. I can't give you any numbers because it's proprietary and it's hard to get those things. But trust me that it's really improved it, and it's also increased, and it's increased their sales dramatically, especially in that first year. But as proud as I am of ClearRx, we're still at the beginning of healthcare innovations, and we've definitely not even come close to reaching a final destination. And I'm committed to continuously improving patient safety, patient care, and the quality of people's lives. And I never forget that this is a continuing and very collaborative process. So let me give you, free of charge, the lifelong lessons that I learned from all this. What separates you from your competitors is neither design nor development. Absolutely not. Instead, it's truly thinking about the person who will be using your design or your development and how that design can meet their needs and solve a very human problem. It doesn't go too far to say that a successful design experience begins by, one, having a love affair with your customer and really digging into your customer's needs. And two, bringing your design skills to bear in solving those needs, both humanly and humanely. But you must never forget that if you can't accept number one, if you can't understand your customer, then number two is really irrelevant and it doesn't matter. And a final word of caution, that's really a motto of encouragement, and I encourage you to take it back to your workplace. Once you begin thinking of a customer's needs, it swiftly becomes a habit, and that habit will lead you unerringly to better design. And best of all, when your work springs from the desire to transform any problem into a desirable customer experience, you're no longer just a designer. You're truly a UX designer, and I salute you. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of Mix.